Welcome to China in Context. I'm Duncan Bartlett. The introduction of advanced surveillance technology has given the Chinese Communist Party more power to spy on its citizens than any regime in history. It collects information relating to people's spending habits, and it's also able to record how they act at work and even in their homes. Why does China want all this data, much of which flows from mobile phones and other devices? And is the state justified in using this surveillance technique to influence people's behavior? Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast today a renowned expert who's ideally placed to help us assess the issues at stake. Mingxin Pei is Professor of Government at Claremont McKenna College in America. He's the author of a recent book entitled The Sentinel State: Surveillance and the Survival of Dictatorship in China. It's published by Harvard University Press. Mingxin, welcome to China in Context.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Now, I'd like to talk to you about the way surveillance is used in China. Your new book, The Sentinel State, is meticulously researched, and you observe that the Chinese Communist Party has become extremely adept at gleaning information from people. Can you say more about its motivation for doing that, please?
Well, the motivation is quite simple. The Communist Party is very, very worried about facing organized political threats. And one way of preventing such threats from emerging is to keep an eye on its people, activities, political activities in particular. And that is, if you can prevent them, if you know what they're about to do and you can prevent them from doing it, then of course you eliminate a very, very substantial threat to the regime existence.
Now, I thought widespread surveillance might be a relatively recent phenomenon. However, your book suggests that China has a history of surveillance going back centuries. People seem to have grown quite used to the idea that spies and informants are everywhere. What do you think lies behind this strong inclination to keep watch over people?
China's Communist Party is just one of the most well-organized and, in the case of Chinese history, the most powerful state China has had. But in Chinese history, there were previous dynasties and other forms of dictatorships that also worry about their own people getting organized and trying to overthrow their power. So in that regard, surveillance is nothing new, because dictators always worry about their own people.
That's interesting you used the word dictator there, because in the title of your book, you mention survival of dictatorship. So can you explain why you've used that particular term in relation to the Chinese Communist Party? It's a slightly provocative phrase, isn't it?
Well, dictatorship, of course, is provocative, but you can use other things like autocracy, or non-democratic systems, which is a mouthful. Dictatorship, in fact, I think it's not provocative at all, because this is a term the Chinese Communist Party prefers to use. And if you look at Deng Xiaoping's four cardinal principles, that these are the four underlying principles of the Chinese Communist Party, one of them is so-called people's dictatorship. So the Communist Party is not averse to using this term. Why should I?
Well, we've had a discussion about whether Xi Jinping should be referred to as a dictator on this podcast before. But anyway, let's go back to your concept here. Surveillance is key to the survival of the dictatorship in China. Tell us more about that.
Repression, or the use of violence against one's potential enemies, or one's known enemies and potential enemies, is a defining characteristic of any dictatorship. But repression is very costly, especially if you use massive violence against an uprising. In the Chinese case, June 4th or Tiananmen Massacre is such a case. There's another form of repression, which is preventive repression. That is, you try to use spying or surveillance to prevent your potential enemies or your enemies from organizing. And this is why surveillance is more useful, because if you use surveillance skillfully and effectively, you can avoid using massive violence. You do not have to lock up a lot of people. You do not have to kill a lot of people. You do not have to incur horrendous reputational loss, such as in the wake of Tiananmen Square. So that is why surveillance is preferred by dictatorships. But surveillance is difficult because surveillance involves a lot of organizational investment, a lot of technological investment, and it requires a very large group of people.
Well, as you say, it does involve the cooperation of a lot of people, and it's not just the Chinese state alone which is collecting all this information. Commercial entities are expected to join in the process. It does sound like there's a huge number of organizations involved, and then there are vast quantities of data to process. How's it all done?
I think for other forms of dictatorship, such as a military dictatorship, or a one person, a personalistic dictatorship, it is much more difficult for these regimes, because these regimes are not very well organized. They do not have organizational presence at the grassroots level. But that's not true for the Chinese Communist Party, because the Chinese Communist Party or such Leninist regimes are the most well-organized dictatorships in the world, because they have tens of millions of members, they have activists, they are everywhere in Chinese society, in commercial establishments, in neighborhoods, in villages. So it is quite, it's much less challenging for this kind of regime to collect information, to recruit informants, and to keep an eye on what is going on in their society. So this is how surveillance at the grassroots level is organized and done.
Getting the information is one thing, but processing it, that's even more difficult, isn't it? So how's that done?
So let me give you an example. Suppose informant A notices something, writes up a report, so that informant would send that report to his or her handler, which is a party functionary, and that handler is better trained. The handler can make an instant judgment, as an evaluation of whether this piece should be classified as enemy intelligence concerning, that would be about the party's political threats, or political intelligence, that is intelligence about what people think about the Communist Party's policies, or social intelligence, that is what is going on in Chinese society. So and then such information gets classified and reported upwards. At some level, there will be a decision made as to whether this is just noise or it is actually signal. Because the party has just so many local officials who have some basic training in differentiating noise from signal, the party can handle such huge amount of information.
You interviewed dissidents for your book. How do they feel about China's system of surveillance?
I think in the case of dissidents, they were on the close watch when they were in China. And of course, that really limited how effective they could be in organizing protests, in maintaining networks, and in just engaging even daily routines. One dissident could not go out to buy cigarettes without without the police following him. In that particular case, the police even offered to buy cigarettes for him so that he could be kept in his house, not causing the police troubles.
I'd like to discuss with you what's known as the social credit system. You explain in your book that this is a way of keeping a record of people's personal behavior, and that a low credit score can lead to negative consequences, for example, a travel ban. And in your book, you wrote, interestingly, about the city of Nanjing. You said that the social credit system there looks out for people who drive under the influence, keep violent or aggressive dogs, or ride public transport without paying for tickets. What's your view of the social credit system?
Okay, now let's talk about the social credit system, both in theory and in practice. In theory, this is like the mother of all surveillance systems, because it has the capability of sucking up really everything. That is what you do, how you spend, blah, blah, blah. And then somehow there is this powerful computer with AI can determine whether you are fed of the Communist Party or you really are not very fond of the Communist Party. This is in theory, but in practice, that's very different. It is a very difficult thing to pull off because the amount of data is huge. How do you integrate data, especially because China is such a huge system, well, a huge country, 1.4 billion people. How do you integrate infrastructure, so forth? So this remains an aspirational system. However, in reality, in practice, local authorities have found very good use of this system because they are now given authority to use the system to penalize certain behavior. So that's why aggressive dogs spitting in the public. In the case of Beijing, electric bikes parked in apartment hallways catch fire when they're plugged in for recharging. So in Beijing, the authorities said, if you park your electric bike in apartment hallways and charge them and they catch fire, you're going to lose social credit. So in most places, my conclusion is that social credit is just becoming another administrative tool to penalize behavior and conduct local authorities do not like.
Well, lastly, I'd like to voice one of my own personal concerns. When I'm looking for news stories online, I often click on boxes which say, allow cookies or allow your location to be used. And I'm often worried there that I might be trapped by a system of mass surveillance, not necessarily involving China, but involving other people from many other countries, including Britain or the United States. What's your perspective?
People know a lot about what we do than we actually know ourselves. This is very frightening. I think, of course, in the case of China, the Communist Party has all the incentives to gain access to such data and then try to use the data to find out what kind of what your political leanings are. And then, of course, the Chinese people have no power to stop their government from doing this. In the case of democratic societies, we really need to do something about this. I think that is why regulations, enforcement on data collection, on privacy are really needed.
Just a second. When you say we need to do something about this, who are you referring to?
Well, we're talking about voters, citizens in democratic society. In the case of China, we can do nothing, but we can do something about our own societies, about our own companies, about companies in the West. If they collect my data in the US, they should not be able to sell the data. What I resent the most is the commercialization of data of consumers, citizens in the West. And the data they collect is not well protected. The other day, one of my students said, Professor Pei, do you drive a certain car? I said, how do you know? I said, I was able to access this trove of data stolen by hackers, and I was able to find your data. This is really frightening.
I share your concern. Thank you, Mingxin. That was a very interesting discussion. That was Professor Mingxin Pei, author of The Sentinel State, Surveillance and the Survival of Dictatorship in China, which is published by Harvard University Press. This podcast is produced by the SOAS China Institute, part of the University of London, and you can find out more about our courses and research at soas.ac.uk. But for now, that's all from us here. on the China in Context podcast team.